Happy New Year, everyone! Ooh. 2024 is going to be great! welcome to episode 9 of Hong Kong Gore. I'm one of your hosts, Wing Ho Lin. My pronouns are he, him.
And I'm Matthew, and my pronouns are he, him, too.
And we're going to like start 2024 with a bang, you know, with... Bang, bang, bang. Is this the first that we're going to like talk about a Stephen Chow film?
Our first Stephen Chow movie.
Yeah. So it's going to be an interesting one. I think, what is your experience with Stephen Chow, actually? Because
So I heard of him ages ago when I think Shaolin Soccer came out.
And, of course, yeah.
Yeah, that crossed over, obviously, in France. That was a big release there. I don't think that I saw it when it came out, but I heard about it. Lots of people were raving about it and saying it was really funny. I didn't see it until I think a few years after, and then I heard a lot more about Kung Fu Hustle, and that's the one I was like, okay, I'm more curious about checking this out than Shaolin Soccer, and I thought it was amazing. Longest time, I really thought that Stephen Chow had only done like that Shaolin Soccer was. Yeah, 2 or 3 actually. You had only done like another movie before this one, and that was it.
Yeah.
Which is far from the truth. Far from it.
I was kind of like, I mean, technically, Shaolin Soccer is a Stephen Chow film that's more internationally friendly compared to his other films. Having said that, though, I'm surprised that not many people who watched those films were like, oh, What has he actually done before? I'll be interested to check him out. But I think they were like probably what you were thinking. Thought, oh, he only made those two films, and those his breakout hits or something like that. I was like, no, he's been around for a long time. I was personally, I've seen Shaolin Soccer at a friend's house, and they made a big deal, and it was an incredibly enjoyable time, and it was an enjoyable film. But it was I think he was very much like, oh, this is Stephen Chow riffing on his usual sort of like shtick, if you want to call it that. Yeah. I'm not saying that it's a bad thing. I'm just saying, oh, he's just doing his normal Stephen Chow thing.
As usual, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But it was a big deal because he was just doing something really sort of innovative with like the soccer, like depicting soccer on film. And B, I think it's been quite a while. There was like somewhat of a gap from his last starring role prior to Shaolin Soccer, and it was kind of like everyone was like, when's Stephen Chow going to come back and make a film? Because I think he was either focusing on other stuff, I think largely directing, and I think that's one of the reasons why it was such a big deal as well at that time. At that time, it was like the highest grossing Hong Kong film history. Yeah, it was like, it earned like 60 million Hong Kong dollars, which is like a big, big deal. Like, let's say for a film to actually be successful, it's either going to be like 30 million or 40 million. And Stephen Chow films tend to hit like the sort of 40 million Hong Kong mark. And that's to Hong Kong stand, by Hong Kong stand, is a big, big deal. So for a film to actually push up to like 60 million is like,
yeah,
unheard of. That has been surpassed recently with that sci-fi film. Oh, what's it called? We've both seen it, and we've both kind of were a little bit lukewarm on it. With Lewis Koo, and it was kind of like Iron Man mixed with Starship Troopers. I can't remember the name of the film.
Yeah, okay, I think I see what you mean. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. That made 70 million, and that was like, oh, okay, that's now like the highest grossing Hong Kong film in history. But anyway, enough about that. I should also thank you in particular, Matt, for the wonderful and surprising Christmas gifts.
Wonderful and surprising
Christmas gifts. You know what? I have to stress the word surprising because I was like,
not expecting gifts at Christmas.
I was expecting gifts at Christmas. I expect a gift from one person because we normally exchange gifts, you know, like pretty much every year. Hi, Gary. So I was like, I'm not doing gifts with anyone else. And they probably won't be doing gifts because, you know, it's like no one has money this year. I was like serving customers, and you could tell that no one gives a shit because I don't have money to actually spend on my kids or like toys and shit, you know. I'm not gonna, and Christmas is cancelled, you know. Everyone became Alan Rickman for like this year, you know. It was kind of, it was a strange sort of feeling. But anyway, I decided last minute to actually spend Christmas with my mother and my brother, which was nice. You know, it was pleasant enough. But for that reason, I was away from my laptop and, frankly, my email account. So you messaged me on my phone. I was like, have you checked your emails? I thought, oh, shit. And I checked my emails and I saw what you did there on my Steam account where you gifted me three games essentially, you know, and I was like, oh shit. And I literally was like, when I get back home, I need to like scramble and like find games for you. I was like, you just wait, Matt. I'm gonna like buy your games. So I hope you like the games there.
Those are good.
You're welcome.
But Devil May Cry Collection is great.
Definitely. Yeah. You know what? I have never played those games, and I heard the first one's pretty good. The second one's pretty bad, and the third one's really great.
I really enjoyed the remake of the first one when I played it on PS4. So I'll be really curious to play finally the original first one.
Yeah.
And the fourth one is really, really fucking fun. Like that whole part where you dance like Michael Jackson, like it's just nonsense. But it's great. I really, really enjoy those games because they're pure action shock.
Yeah.
Which is something that can also be said about what you probably want to talk about now.
Yes. Well, I really, really want to talk about, you know, I think it was the previous episode, and we've spoken about this outside the podcast, how much I, not loathe, I think that's a very strong word, but, you know, I love fighting games. As you know, I do love fighting games.
But, do you? Breaking news. Breaking news
in Hong Kong. You talk about fight films, you know, Hong Kong action films, but was never really keen on the Mortal Kombat franchise. And I will have to preface this with like my history of the Mortal Kombat franchise. I never grew up with a console. Like the first console I had was a Nintendo, and then for the rest of the time it was essentially Game Boy. So I never really played sort of video games unless I'm like at a friend's house. And most of my friends, you know, they like Mortal Kombat, but I think, you know, because of how violent they were, most of them, their parents would be like, no, you're not playing that game. So I never really, my exposure to Mortal Kombat was always like a distant observer. And I've always been keen in Mortal Kombat, not the games, but rather the films. The first film I've seen was Annihilation, which I know everyone kind of like loves to like shit on, but I kind of find it an enjoyable film despite its faults and for many, and even because of its faults. Then I rented the first Mortal Kombat film from my local library and I was like, this was pretty cool. And I really like, and from there on, I was like, okay, I really dig the Mortal Kombat lore, even though it's just silly, you know, schlocky kung fu sort of mystical martial arts movie. And the thing about the franchise is that it is very much inspired by cinema. I think more so than any other fighting games. I mean, in fighting games in general, they are inspired by cinema, particularly, let's say, like, I think the first fighting game that was ever created was actually, I think the people who created it, they were inspired by, let's say, Bruce Lee, and particularly Game of Death. And if you look at the premise of Game of Death, it's all about going up a pagoda of, like, multiple layers and fighting different opponents until you fight the final boss, per se.
Yeah, so a video game.
And they translated that into video game logic very well. I think with the Mortal Kombat franchise, it's a lot more prevalent because
you have the actors.
Well, if you look at the
characters, it's like stunts, basically. You do stunts.
Yeah, exactly. And the characters in themselves are inspired by real life martial arts stars. I mean, Liu Kang being an obvious riff of Bruce Lee, Johnny Cage is being a riff of Jean-Claude Van Damme. In fact, I think they actually asked Jean-Claude Van Damme when he's quite early in his career, would you like to come in and like play a video game character? And Sonya Blade, apparently is a riff of Cynthia Ruffrock.
So that would make sense. Yeah,
it makes total sense. Yeah. They definitely do have a similar look.
Yeah, I thought it was official actually that she was an inspiration.
Maybe not official, but
like that's in documentaries.
They were I think in hindsight, I think especially as the games were further in, like the fourth or fifth games, they were like, this is definitely a Cynthia Ruffrock reference. And even the premise is like, oh yeah, this is clearly like a riff of like Into the Dragon, where villain invites martial arts to his island to actually have a martial arts tournament. I was like, all right, you know. So very, it loves referencing martial arts cinema. And I've only played, like, let's say a few games. And let me go through the games that I actually played as a child. Okay, the first ever Mortal Kombat game I played was actually Mortal Kombat 4.
Okay.
On the Game Boy Color, which was pretty bad.
Nintendo adaptation of Mortal Kombat, I think, are probably generally controversial because it doesn't work with Nintendo violence and Nintendo,
it really doesn't work, and it's kind of like, and you know, it was you know, the combat was really rubbish, I have to say. And I think I'm not saying that because I'm shitting on it, you know, other people have said it,
and since probably I think the Wii, I think it's clear to me that Nintendo was completely and was probably never really interested in high definition, high technological. They're always looking for other types of innovation.
Yeah.
Like it's never going to be about like, oh, look how realistic those characters are. Like which of their consoles actually focused on any of that?
None. Yeah. And Mortal Kombat 4 was actually the first game that was actually in 3D, whereas prior to that, it was all done like, it was kind of semi-rotoscoping, but it's not, and it's like, it's all pixels and stuff, so photography type of like sort of graphics.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And then fast forward, because I was so unimpressed with Mortal Kombat 4, I didn't touch any of the game, and then Deadly Alliance came out, and I actually really enjoyed that. I think that was the fifth game, and because there was quite a gap between 4 and Deadly Alliance, and that game I actually did enjoy because they have this really interesting mechanic where each fighter has three modes, essentially three martial arts styles, two unarmed and one with a weapon, and you can actually switch either way. And it's like, as a teen who was getting into martial arts and the different esoteric sort of systems that each martial arts sort of represented, this I was like all over it. I was like, oh yeah, this guy knows praying mantis kung fu, oh wow, this guy knows like Sing Yi, like there are like some like deep cuts in terms of like, oh, this guy knows a Shaolin, or you know, and this one knows a screamer, and that's really interesting. I think looking back on it, I don't know how much that affected gameplay in terms of balance, like whether it in terms of like matchups, does it really like really make a difference, or was it like it was just a surface level type thing.
Yeah, cosmetic.
Cosmetic thing, you know. So I don't know how much it really did change the gameplay. But for me, as a kid who was really into martial arts and trying to like, you know, look at different martial arts and what each one offers, it really, it really did capture like my interest. And I think Mortal Kombat 11 has that. It doesn't have the style switching system, but you can tell that each character has a distinctive fighting style. Like Johnny Cage is like, you know, he's kind of like Jeet Kune Do with a sort of with an element of martial arts tricking, you know, which is, you know, reflective of his personality because he's like a former movie star. Where else? And you get Sonya Blade, excuse me, who's more kind of like a taekwondoist, you know, and there's a little bit of grappling as well, because I think she's actually shaped after her voice actress, which is Ronda Rousey, who was like an MMA fighter. That's actually sort of really interesting.
I didn't know that, exactly.
I felt like with Mortal Kombat 11, the way they sort of like you know, give everyone a martial arts sort of system that reflects their personality is actually, you know, very interesting. Minus, you know, obviously the sort of like the ninja characters, which are, you know, you can tell that, you know, like, I can, like, let's say Scorpion, he has, compared to like his first iteration in like the first few films, it never occurred to me that, you know, Scorpion and Sub-Zero, it was like Sub-Zero was actually from China and Scorpion's from Japan. Never really occurred to me from like the very first games until much, much further on, where it's like, oh, Scorpion uses a katana and, you know, and uses like Japanese martial arts, and whereas with Sub-Zero, he's more of a Chinese martial artist. So I was like, that's actually quite an interesting sort of distinction, you know. And obviously there are, you know, the game does keeps true to the riffs they're playing on, like Liu Kang is still Bruce Lee, Johnny Cage is still Van Damme, and, you know, Sonya Blade is still Cynthia Ruffrock, but kind of like also Ronda Rousey as well. It's just very nice that the game is so reverential to like the cinema that it was inspired by, and yet make it work organically in the game.
Well, yeah, because also I think the stories were really ties up everything very well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, it's essentially, I was like looking at the story and I was playing the story mode and, you know, really enjoyed the story and realizing halfway that time travel, hang on, this is essentially fucking Avengers Endgame, but in my opinion, done kind of better. Like when they were like, the final battle, I expected Liu Kang to be like, Avengers Assemble, you know, almost, with the lightning and stuff, because it was like, oh, okay, this is kind of like, am I taking crazy pills here? This feels like watching Avengers, but kind of better, you know, or at least, you know, keeping with my taste, you know.
You cannot say Avengers Assemble because there's no K in there. And that's what you have to get with Mortal Kombat, is like there has to be so like conquer with a K. Like, yeah, that's
conquer
not
with a K. Conquest.
Thank God this game is not for children, because otherwise like the grammar error that would come up, right? Like,
oh god.
Can Johnny, like that's not how you write. Where's K's everywhere? Oh, yeah. Oh.
Can you imagine if Mortal Kombat was owned by Disney?
That'd be terrible. Don't do that. Mortal Kombat 11 is fantastic for the story.
It's
just a brilliant game.
I want to give special mention to the character Kung Lao. Now, Kung Lao is I find, like, throughout the years, I always found that, because Kung Lao is known to be the Kung Fu, the Shaolin brother of Liu Kang. And he's kind of like, he's an interesting character, because he's essentially Shaolin, but trust fund kid.
You know, right,
like, you know, because as the name suggests, he's an ancestor to the great Kung Lao, and I think he was raised to be Earthrealm's like champion until Liu Kang came along and it's like, no, sorry, trust fund kid, you know, step aside, kind of thing.
They have a good relationship.
They had a good relationship.
Even their evil counterparts do seem to get along.
Yeah,
so
they're
real friends.
But I always never really got Kung Lao as a character. He's always a character that's somewhat like attached to Liu Kang. Like he could easily like have anybody else attached to Liu Kang, and it kind of wouldn't make a difference, because I always found that Kung Lao never had he lacked distinction as a character. You know, I think. I think in Deadly Alliance, I think what they were trying to do was trying to have these two characters represent different two specific genres of Hong Kong action cinema. Like, Liu Kang is Bruce Lee, so he represents the more, you know, grounded kung fu films of like the 70s, whereas Kung Lao, I think, represents wuxia, the more, you know, the flying swordsman type character. And you can tell from his outfit, his attire, and his long flowing hair, he very much represents that side. But again, he's only like, he's representing essentially an archetype of a character, and that isn't really enough to actually give you character. Whereas with Liu Kang, yes, he's representing, you know, kung fu films, but he's also like a riff of Bruce Lee, which is quite distinct away from those kung fu films, you know, especially compared to like the stuff from the 70s, where Bruce Lee was his kind of like his own thing, and yet he's still recognized as the more kung fu sort of, he's still represented as more like, yeah, he's all about kung fu films and not about wuxia and like flying around, whereas Kung Lao was more about, you know, the more flowy, more flowery type movements and more mystical elements about it.
The very big distinction really between those two is that Yu Kang is the very heroic and like to a fault. He's got an extremely strong moral compass.
Yeah.
Whereas Kung Lao is a bit more
he's kind of like a spoiled kid, I guess, if you want to put it in those terms.
It's not too over the top that he becomes annoying. He's not Scrappy Doo to Liu Kang's Scooby Doo. He still has a moral compass, but he doesn't always rely on it, and that's why he's slightly less charismatic.
This is where I think I have to give developers credit, because I think in Mortal Kombat 11, and to some extent X as well, with the previous installment, because I think you can see elements of that there as well, is that, because if you look at Kung Lao's fighting style, you see that they've changed it up a bit, and it was like, and I noticed they gave Kung Lao Wing Chun as his primary fighting style, and I was like, some of his sort of specials and brutalities involved him doing like the machine gun type punching that Donnie Yen did from the Ip Man films. And it's like, that's what they're riffing on now.
Right.
Kung Lao, so basically Liu Kang is a riff of Bruce Lee. Kung Lao is a riff of the Donnie Yen from the Ip Man films with Wing Chun. And I was like, and that's when Kung Lao finally got his own sort of like, okay, this is what I bring to the table in terms of like my character, my distinction, while also what I'm bringing in from like, you know, reference to a specific type of martial arts cinema. And automatically I was like, yes, Kung Lao is like a character, in my opinion. I know that sounds weird saying that, but you know what I mean?
Makes sense.
He feels like a more fully formed character, as opposed to someone who's just, he's Liu Kang's brother. I was like, no, he's like, he's also his own thing now, you know?
Yeah, kind of thing, and he's got to have probably a lot more in the latest Mortal Kombat, which I haven't played because it's way too expensive for me. Yeah. Like, I'm most interested in this game for the story. Like, 60 or 70 euros to pay for a game. Like, I'm sorry, but that's not going to fucking happen.
And I heard the DLC stuff is just... I mean, Mortal Kombat has always been kind of controversial in terms of its DLCs or its crypt or how it earns...
I
won't go into it because I'm not, you know, I'm not that deep in it and I don't care for it really, but
that's the thing, like, I'll get those games when they are less than 10 and then I enjoy them very much and I will praise them for what they are, because they are extremely well made, but like,
they are, you know, I will get
Gabriel, I'm not that excited. I can wait. I can easily wait.
As can I. But when I realize that Kung Lao is essentially Ip Man, and it makes... And you know what? It makes the Kung Lao Liu Kang connection all the more, I guess, meaningful, or all the more interesting, I guess, because Bruce Lee and Ip Man were connected, you know, and to actually have these two connected by that, using those, using those real life figures, that's what make their relationships a lot more interesting and a lot more sort of like, I can see it. And, you know, and it gives Kung Lao more distinction away from Liu Kang, which, you know, I've always think... he always had a problem with, is like, he lacks meaning where Liu Kang's not around, essentially.
Yeah. So the new one, probably, I think, from what I've seen in the trailer of the new game, that does leave the impression that yes, Kung Lao will have a lot more to do in the new one, considering what the new status quo is at the end of Mortal Kombat 11, which we won't discuss. Because we really want, I think I really want people to enjoy it. It's such a fun story. It's so stupid.
It's schlocky, but yet somehow the emotional stakes is actually a usually weird, you know, genuine emotional stakes that I find myself, I'm actually quite invested here.
You gotta give it up to the actors who do the motion capture for this game. Yeah. Like, the writing is solid, but what really sells it is the motion capture, is all the actors,
like
all those people do give really, really excellent performance. If it wasn't for them, you'd have a lot of just kind of bland.
There's just so much personality in it, and despite, so and I much. think and I think despite and you know that really help sell the schlockiness. The, you know, they, like, there was this moment between Liu Kang and Kung Lao where they're in this sort of like, when they entered the Shaolin Temple and there's like a dungeon where there's multiple traps and they're kind of like sort of competing with each other. It was like, how do they get through this one particular trap? And, you know, Liu Kang does it with, you know, ease, and then you could see Kung Lao's face being like, there's this tiny little smirk where I was like, yeah, all right then.
Yeah, I'm not impressed. Like, you're over.
Move over. Let the trust fund kid show how it's really done, kind of thing. So yeah, it's just moments like this that really adds personality to another one, you know.
Yeah, or Johnny Cage. Johnny Cage, especially when he's confronted to his younger self, it's hilarious. Because the younger Johnny Cage is even more annoying than he was in the earlier game.
I think that is kind of relatable because, you know, most adults would just look at their younger selves and be like, oh God, I'm glad I'm okay. You know, if I ever get I was really like surprised by how they, you know, they killed off Sonya Blade in the beginning, you know, and how that meant something, even though they got, you know, they brought her back, what, the younger version of her,
but they bring it's not the same character,
and yet so the death is still meaningful. And this is something about, you know, game stories, is that they're afraid to actually even the best fighter games like Street Fighter, they're afraid to actually sort of change the status quo, so everything kind of stays the same. Here, I find that the Mortal Kombat games or the Mortal Kombat story, they're one of the, and I think Guilty Gear is actually true. This is also true of Guilty Gear, is that they want to move the story along and they're not afraid to sort of change up the status quo. Like when, spoiler alert, when the younger Sonya Blade kills off Kano, I thought it was kind of like, oh, they're doing it for keeps here, you know. Do you know what I mean? It's like I generally really like was somewhat taken aback because, you know, I think it's because it's like it's so violent and people, you know, from the injuries you should not have survived and they do, and then to have a scene where, you know, Sonya Blade, you know, shoots a Kano and actually kill his younger version timeline, because he killed the older, what was it, he kills the younger version, by that he kills the older version as well,
exactly,
and make it final. That is something that I was kind of taken aback with. And you know what, it kind of reminds me of the opening of the film Mortal Kombat Annihilation, where they killed spoilers, but it's a film from 97, just, and I think everyone knows what happens, where they killed off Johnny Cage, and that was meant to be like meaningful, but doesn't affect the whole film at all. Whereas when in this version, Mortal Kombat 11, they kind of do a similar thing where they kill off Sonya Blade, and that affects everyone throughout the whole entire story. And I think it's like, you know, how they sort of like make choices, you know, how they, and even like when the younger versions come back, it's kind of like, I don't know how to deal with this, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. It is true that the grief still inhabits very, even if just on surface, because obviously the story moves on for more fighting, and that's also the thing with death in Mortal Kombat, because you fight characters and then they break your skull in multiple bones, you see like fractures everywhere, and they get up and they're fine, like the game doesn't try to justify at all what happens between the fights versus when somebody dies in cutscenes, because that makes no sense technically.
No,
but like
really.
it's never really an issue.
Yeah, it never really takes me out of the story, which I would have thought it would actually. It was like, oh, you know, it's kind of like if I see Cassie Cage do like a fatality on her mum, I'm like, I don't know if I could be able to accept that. But for some reason, I kind of do, because it's like, you know, maybe I'm desensitized at this point.
It's the rules of Mortal Kombat.
It's the rules of Mortal Kombat, you know, kind of. To be fair, in the story mode, they don't let you do the fatalities. I will say that. So I think...
Oh, yeah, no.
So the developers, actually, I think are quite conscious of the fact that, yeah, we're not going to make you do fatalities in story mode, because that's not where that belongs. That belongs in paid mode, or their equivalent of. Do you know what I mean? Because that's a separate thing. Yeah.
this so, yeah. like this the death and brutality is very, very gruesome, which yeah. also brings back, and I think we talked about it last time though, but it's brings back to that whole controversy was around Mortal Kombat 11 when people were forced, developers were forced to watch like accidents and stuff
like
to
PTSD
make, make it realistic, and it's so uncalled for people to have forced anyone to do any of this, because not only is it just not like it's you can't force people to do shit like that, like that's just terrible, they're just fucked up, that's an abuse of power,
and combining with the whole crunch time, so they constantly have to, like, you know, it's watch nonsense. It
But at the same time, also, it's not even necessary because it's so ridiculous. Would you care that this this femoral artery is not realistic? Am I coming to play Mortal Kombat 11 for the realism? The realism of time travel with people come back from the dead with their evil self. Oh, yeah. Great. That's so realistic. What I'm concerned about.
I mean, I think it's funny because, don't get me wrong, Mortal Kombat 11 is an incredibly violent game with the fatalities, but it's so violent that it's kind of comical that you can't really take it seriously. I'd be surprised if someone did take it seriously, to be fair.
I mean, there are always people who probably take it seriously. There's people who would take seriously like pure nonsense like every day, but if you have half a brain, you will understand that none of this makes sense.
I was like, bodies don't act like that. You don't kick people in the gonads and their skull pops out of their heads, you know? So that's how bodies happen.
That doesn't work at all. Nope. Children, that's not, like, you can't pass your medical exam.
Don't learn anatomy or biology from this game at all. You know?
Yeah, that's not a disclaimer that should be put anywhere. Like, it's basically the equivalent of asking somebody else, like, did you learn how to do anatomy playing, like, the doctor game where
you know how to do surgery, right? Yeah, I was so good at that game, right? I could work on your heart, you know?
It was bring like, that tumor up, baby. I'll take care of it. Like, no.
No, thank you.
No.
But I have to say, I guess I'm kind of coming around with Mortal Kombat. You know, I mean, don't get me wrong, the fight, you know, the fighting's, it's, I still prefer games like Guilty Gear and even like Under Night In Birth, I still prefer the Arc System fighting games. Those are kind of like my bag. Having said that, you know, after playing Mortal Kombat 11, I even enjoyed the combat. I really did enjoy the combat and like how each, you know, character has his own sort of esoteric fighting style. I'm recognizing certain movements from certain martial arts. I was like, oh, this is kind of cool. It kind of reminded me, you know, when I was playing Deadly Alliance, you know, way back when in 2003, when I was in secondary school. So yeah, thank you, Matt, for the wonderful gift. I will be playing
The Gift of Life.
The gifts of life.
The gift that is life.
That gift that is life, which involves a lot of people like killing people in gruesome and grotesque ways. I'm going to be playing the Aftermath.
Yes, as you should. Oh, yeah.
because of Shang Tsung. You can't match that. You know, speaking of reverence.
The actor is amazing. The actor who plays Shang Tsung is so amazing. The scenery.
Never left the actor. It's as if I was like transported back in time. And I didn't watch it when it was released, but I watched it when it was like a few years later, like 98. It's like I was transported back in time when I rented that video from the library and I watched it. I was like, yep, Shang Tsung, I'm gonna that's my kind of guy, you know.
He's great. He should be more Shang Tsung. Like, this guy could play that role like forever. I'll still be the time.
No, absolutely.
Bless you,
dude, sir, indeed. Anyway, enough about Mortal Kombat 11, and you know, onto the main subject. This isn't a podcast about Mortal Kombat 11, but I just wanted to like mention it because it has a lot of, you know, references to Hong Kong cinema, so I think it's tangentially related.
Absolutely.
But from Beijing with love, starring Stephen Chow and Anita Yun. Oh, Stephen Chow as Ling Ling Tut, which essentially means 007, 007.
Yes, 007, as they write it in the subtitles.
I have the Blu-ray as well, and I was like looking at it, is that a spelling mistake? But no, that clearly isn't. That's clearly intentional.
I think they really wanted every joke that wasn't that needed to be translated, that was too close to language barrier. Like that would like they did a really good job. It's silly, but like the whole movie is silly, so it really works.
Absolutely.
So
yeah,
congrats also to people who did the translation on this, because it works.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the fact that they actually went off, because the thing is that I actually, for the longest time, I've seen the film. I have it on like VCD and then later on DVD, and they never translated the big Chinese characters on the truck until like today, and I realized I can't read Chinese. I was like, that's pretty fucking funny. How did I not notice that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's from the get-go. Yeah.
I have to say
to preface this movie and our discussion about it, have to say, so going in, first of all, you talked about doing this movie ages ago.
Yes.
And I couldn't do it because Eureka only released fairly recently the DVD. And it was available in French, but with French titles, which I didn't want to do because I usually watch with them with my partner when he speaks and reads English. So I wanted to wait. So I made this delay the review for
which
this
is
movie.
Fair. No, I didn't mind.
Three months. But when I got it, I put it on the player. I only realized at that point, I was like, oh, it's a James Bond parody.
Oh, really? Oh, hang
the
on.
The fact that this is called From Beijing with Love, the fact that it stars on the cover somebody dressed as a spy, at no point during all those months did I think, is this a James Bond parody?
Oh,
no,
God.
That never
okay.
occurred to me. And it's only when I put on the Blu-ray and just started playing it, I was like,
yeah, because it has the
thickest man on earth.
But it has the opening credits, but there was like a disclaimer saying that this is
it starts off even before that by a message saying like, this is no relation to James Bond. I was like, something tells me it's gonna be a long relation to James Bond.
Exactly.
And yes, it was.
Which actually, that disclaimer never occurs in any other versions of like the film. There's like even the DVD and the VCDs, they don't actually have that disclaimer in the beginning. So that's a nice little addition. I wonder if they took it out for the home release and they just put it back in for this one, because I bet they did show that in cinemas.
Yeah,
as kind of like an
it sounds
joke.
More like a joke, right?
It's an ironic joke. It's an ironic joke kind of thing. But yeah, Stephen Chow as Ling Ling Tut, Anita Yun as Lei Han Kam, which is actually a reference to a popular sort of like Japanese figure. We'll go into that a little bit. There's Luo Gaoying as Da Man Zai, who in the subtitles was known as Leonardo da Vinci.
Yes,
is that right? Yeah,
exactly. So they kept doing a joke around it. It was what felt like a joke, where he was asking like, call me Da Vinci, and then he's called Vinci.
Yeah.
And I was like, is it like, so that's not funny? Like, is it supposed to be funnier?
I think that's more of a Cantonese play on words, you know, kind
right,
of thing.
That's what
it's kind of like, you know, it's like Manzai, you know, kind of thing. No, I'm just going to call you that. So call me for my full name. It's like, it's kind of like, I don't know what would be the equivalent, you know. If someone said, you know, hey Malone, I was like, I'd rather you call me my full name post Malone. All right, Malone, you know, kind of thing. It's
right,
kind of
okay.
like that, you know. It's like it's kind of like a disrespect type of thing. And he's come in to be, and the character's meant to be sort of like not be among the sort of like the spy organization. So it kind of that's kind of like the hue that's where the humor comes out.
Yeah,
you know,
he wants
kind of
to be Q, but he's definitely not Q.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, the idea of like Da Vinci is that he's like, it's a respectful sort of like figure in history, but you're not gonna. So he's incorporating that name, and it's like he wants everyone to call him Da Vinci because he wants to be respected and be taken seriously, only to be like people tell, you know, calling him, oh, I'm gonna call you like half the name because you're not, you don't measure up. I think that's essentially the joke, right, of it. Wong Kam Gong as Golden Gun, I believe that's his name, but he who's also the commander of the military, of the sort of like the Chinese military. He's like Stephen Ling Ling Chan's boss in the film, and spoiler alert, it turns out to be the main villain.
But that's not even a spoiler really, because it's revealed
really like what, literally like 10 minutes into the film, you know, movie, so, yeah, something like, ridiculous, oh, like that. Yeah, exactly.
But that's the joke. Actually, it's a better joke than having like a stupid reveal. It's like, oh, yeah, it turns out like a suspense thing where, yeah, like, I wonder where that is. Oh yeah, my god, it's him all along. Whereas like, yeah, no, it's just him. It's, yeah, a better way to do
I thought
it.
You know, I'd rather it was that. And then there's the sort of like the side characters, like Pauline Chan as Mystery Woman, or as you call it,
the flamethrower breast lady. Because that's who she is. She's the flamethrower breast lady.
Who's, you know, who's, you know, very much in keeping with like the sort of like the femme fatale figures of like the sort of like the early James Bond films. She's kind of like, I mean, you mentioned on your notes that Stephen Chow was riffing, if he was riffing on any Bond, he was riffing off the Roger Moore era, which makes sense. So in my head, it's kind of like this is essentially A View to Kill, and Pauline Chan is essentially kind of like, what's the actress name? Nora Jones?
Not Nora Jones, because she's a Ravi Shankar's daughter and the popular jazz singer.
Jazz singer, yeah. Who am I talking? Who am I thinking of?
View to Kill.
Hang on.
Oh, Tanya Roberts? Grace Jones.
Grace Jones, yes.
Yes, two very different people, yes.
Sorry.
In many, many ways.
I mean, I was halfway there, you know. but yeah, she's kind of like, you know, the sultry sort of femme fatale sort of type James Bond character. And then we've got Joe Chang, metal death killer, who's playing Jaws, guys, you know.
It's Jaws, yeah.
Yeah,
the riff on Jaws is that basically instead of having big teeth, he's got bad teeth.
Yeah, you know, exactly. And it's like, oh, but yeah, so those are essentially all the main characters,
I have to say though, if because the fact that I'm chuckling to the fact that it's the joke is that instead of having big teeth, he's got bad teeth, should give you an idea of the type of humor that you're being faced with. And if this didn't make you chuckle or even have a smile, I think this movie isn't for you.
No, yeah,
but if you like that type of joke, you're in for a treat.
Yeah, okay. So, do you want to go for a plot synopsis? Shall we do a plot synopsis?
Yes.
Yeah, why not? Okay, so Ling Ling Tut is a pork vendor, spending his days selling meat, drinking dry martinis, and fraternizing with the local prostitutes without paying them. That is until one day out of the blue. It's true. I'm not saying that. It's like it's what's in the film. This is until first 5 minutes. Until one out of the blue, his former sort of, I guess, colleague Manzai turns up to bring him a new mission to retrieve a dinosaur cranium from the evil villain Golden Gun. And I also wrote that he's kind of also like you said, he was like a riff of like the Tokusatsu characters, and I think you're absolutely right. I thought my head immediately went to like RoboCop, but I think it's
true.
But it also makes more sense that because he seems more Tokusatsu actually than RoboCop in my opinion. So
yeah, he does more actions.
Yeah, it's very Japanese. Like the way he's like taken out is very Japanese, with the chambara sort of single stroke style, where he's just there's a pause and then suddenly a spurt of blood. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. Assisting Tut is the resourceful Lei Han Kam, played by Anita Yun. However, it's turned out that she's secretly working under Golden Gun. She's really trying to throw Tut off the scent while her boss is busy away doing evil shenanigans, until she gets the order to find off him. However, she soon starts falling for Tut, despite so many negative things about his personality, which leads to a final showdown where Tut must finally face the real villain. But will he come out of it alive and in the arms of the love of his life? Excuse me.
So essentially, it's a Stephen Chow movie with a Stephen Chow plot, because really the love affair and then him being like the strongest but also the dumbest is basically what he does in most of his movies.
Yep.
And then at the end, yeah, like, so it's really like a Stephen Chow template.
Oh, there's absolutely.
There's no originality in that department.
Yeah, I will say out of all the Stephen Chow films, I will say that From Beijing with Love is at his most subtle. And I know that you may be raising an eyebrow there, but just hear me out. Like, if you look at all his Stephen Chow films, he's actually like more over the top and more fast talking than he is in this film. Like when he he doesn't fast talk and he doesn't make big expressions, whereas in past films he's all about big expressions and sticking his tongue out and acting like a real buffoon, whereas his buffoonies right. are more about like, oh, he's just a bit, he's oblivious of his own sort of buffoonery almost. Like he's trying to act like the cool suave one and then sort of like not realizing that he's actually kind of like
well, he's basically, yeah. I think he really thinks he's Roger Moore. I guess
he's trying to keep up that act and try to hide the fact that, yeah,
but
maybe
Roger Moore was always kind of snappy and like ironic in the way he delivered lines. So
the thing
with the way Stephen Chow delivered those lines is that, yes, he is somehow ironic, but he also really wants to be or thinks of himself as
a suave, cool,
more suave.
Roger Moore, yeah.
Yeah, even when he plays on the piano and like he's singing the lyrics.
Yeah, and he's being very soulful. And it's stupid cigarette on his bottom lip that makes it like.
And then at some point, he does say, like, but I forgot this part of the lyrics.
And
he just moves on. It's almost the kind of stuff that Bruce Campbell does in the third Evil Dead movie, where he's just like, he's trying to say the formula, but he goes like, in Santine, Dominus, Santis.
It's like, you know that it's kind of, oh, you're now just making shit up now, aren't you?
Yeah, it's that same kind of like cartoon confidence that he's got. Mm. And that really works. For me, this movie felt a lot like watching Zsasz. Like Airplane or Leslie Nielsen movie.
Oh, yeah.
He's got the same confidence as Leslie Nielsen for me in this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, you know what? That is a good, yeah, that's a good way. That's a very good equivalent to actually sort of work from. That's the type of humor one should expect from that film. And if you can dig Leslie Nielsen, you can definitely dig this film.
Yeah. The report to sex is also very much like Leslie Nielsen. Particularly when it comes to one of the best scene of this movie, where it comes to diverting the flow of blood.
Oh my god, you don't need aesthetic, you just need a porn video, kind
of. Oh, genius idea.
I like the fact that, you know, halfway through, you know, you could see that Anita Yun's character is actually getting into it. It's like, oh, you know what, you can watch it later, just sort out my leg, please, you know. But this film, I mean, as a James Bond parody, yes, there's a lot, you know, it is riffing off James Bond, but I think you can see that Stephen Chow's a big fan of films and also just has the, you know, has a, is close to the pulse of, is that the term? It's very, he knows about the current pop culture.
Yes.
Of his time. Like, this film doesn't riff off James Bond, but he actually riffs on Wong Kar-wai films, like particularly Chungking Express, because Chungking Express actually came out the same year. So there's actually a scene where, because you can see, like, in the very beginning, he's always about being melancholic about, oh, you know, I thought,
right,
you know, us, you know, being like, have spending a night together was all about, you know, love and relationships, not about money. And that's indicative of his character being a kind of a shitty person. But it's also like, that's a reference to those Wong Kar-wai films where it is about this falling deeply in love with someone and not being reciprocated. And there's even a scene where Stephen Chow's character literally like lifts up his dry martini, like really slowly, where everything else moves at a speedy pace.
Right.
That's a Wonga Wei sort of like signature cinematic trait called step printing, or it's a combination of step printing and undercracking, where the main subject is moving slow motion, where everything else is moving incredibly fast. And that's kind of like a symbolism of like how your main character is like stuck in the past while everything is like moving along. You know, do you know what I mean? He's being left behind because he doesn't want to move on. You know, his mind and body is still stuck in the past because he's still holding on to like past loves. And it's kind of like him, you know, taking the piss out of that film in Chunky, you know, and taking the piss out of Wonga Wei.
That sucks. I haven't seen Chunky Express.
Yeah. And it's all, actually, and also another Wonga Wei reference is where he, you know, when he like cleans himself up and actually, you know, in his small apartment, that scene is essentially a piss take of a scene in Days of Being Wild, which is another Wonga Wei film where Tony Leung pretty much does the same thing. You know, he cleans himself up before going out night in the town, you know, kind of thing. And that's Stephen Chow fancying himself as like, I'm Tony Leung, you know, I'm as just as smart as this guy kind of thing.
That makes sense, because this, now that you explain this, there's parts of From Beijing with Love where I thought, there's parts of the movies that felt a bit slow and didn't, where the jokes weren't hitting me, but I think it's because I was missing those references.
Yeah, there are definitely more. It goes beyond James Bond reference. It does do other stuff as it does, you know, reference other stuff as well, which I think there's another big, but before you go on, there's actually another big one that is actually quite, that acts as like a sort of a big deal in terms of like his character traits, but go on.
No, like that's all I wanted to say is that outside of the American reference that I picked up on, there's all those elements that really related to like maybe not Hong Kong cinema, but like more just Chinese culture in general, where I felt like, oh, okay, like I don't have, like that doesn't translate well, because the rest of the movie really relies a lot on the absurd to and visual gags. Because I think one of the main thing I've come to think of comedy probably as the hardest thing to translate. Comedy always relies on cultural context.
Yeah.
And if you don't have the cultural context, well, you're not going to get the joke, because no amount of notes will help you understand, okay, well, this is fun because this and this and this.
Yeah.
That reminds me of, I went to a conference ages ago about the about translation, and one of the guy that spoke there talked about the series Mackies by Toonie Millionaire. It's a series of a strip comic, that beautifully, really gorgeously illustrated by Toonie Millionaire, and but a lot of the jokes are so poetic that it's really impossible to translate, and a lot of it is hard to make sense because you have to go with the flow of the overall cartoon. And he said, like, it's impossible to translate, because to translate it, you'd have to basically call the author for every line and say, what do you mean by that? And with humor, for me, it's the same thing. You have to rely on the context of the time, culturally, particularly maybe the region. Like you mentioned, the things that came out around the same time. And if that you don't have that diagram, you're screwed. So for things like all the jokes that rely on James Bond's Zaz kind of zany humor, it works. Works regardless of the cultural context, because you can see that it's absurd. It's still funny. It works as an absurdist comedy, but everything else is just lost. And I think that's probably why we would, like, it would be rare for us to really talk about a comedy, because it relies so much on explaining everything.
Yeah, particularly like, Stephen Chow
film.
Funny
because of this.
And it's
Stephen
like
Chow at least is accessible. Like, for some of his movies,
he's definitely,
it's like, all right.
Yeah, there are definitely films. It's funny because, you know, a lot of people say, oh, yeah, I love Shaolin Soccer, but I don't know if I'd be able to, you know, go enjoy his back catalogue as much. And to the extent, I would say that's kind of true, but you need to know what your... I think you need someone to sort of like direct you to in the right direction. I think that's why I chose From Beijing with Love, because, you know, everyone knows James Bond, and it does have good sight gags and good sort of visual humor that people can latch on. Yes, there are Cantonese humor that is specific to Cantonese culture or pop culture even. But I think there's enough here in the film that people can actually sort of grasp hold of. I will... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, actually, and the good thing with James Bond is that it's absurd. It's an absurd premise.
Yeah, it's always been an absurd premise.
And it's played straight.
Yeah.
So you can easily parody that. Because you have all those elements that are like, wait, how much money do you spend? Like, why is this supposed to be a spy? But yet he makes things explode.
Yeah.
Like, exactly. None of this.
Why is this guy not
logical, fired? Yeah, exactly. Why is this guy on fire? Like, why is he supposed to be this greatly revered secret agent? And that's why you have so many James Bond parodies, because he's insufferable.
Like,
Sean Connery is charismatic as hell, but he's also insufferable.
Yeah, he's Roger kind Moore, of a dick.
Yeah, oh, he's a complete dick. I mean, the simple fact that when Roger Moore showed up to make his first James Bond movie, they had a scene where he slaps a woman, and apparently he famously would have turn around to the director going like, that's the last time you make me do this. Like, I'm never doing this ever again. I'm not slapping woman. And like, Sean Connery had no problem doing that. All right, left and right.
Jesus.
Which is everywhere. I don't care. And it's like, no, like, as the time evolved, you make them a bit more responsible. And Daniel Craig is a lot more responsible.
Yeah.
And ironically, unfortunately for me, those movies work much less. I have no sympathy. I love Danny Craig. I think he's a really wonderful actor, but I have no sympathy for him, James Bond. Mm-hmm. He's just too mopey, and that's not what I want. But that's the result of years and years of the character being built on a premise that's impossible to live with and absurd.
And you know, you're like, what, 50 films in? How do you still make that character relevant to like the time, you know, kind of thing?
Yeah, it doesn't really work. It works for Batman. Strangely enough, it does work for Batman.
But I think the only reason that character worked because I think especially with like superhero characters or comic book characters, I think I don't know who wrote this, but there was an introduction that sort of like does well to sort of like explain why Batman works all these years. I think it was like in like an opening of like Frank Miller's Year One, is that Batman in many ways never grew up. So the very concept of actually, you know, dressing up as a bat and going out and fight crime is a very childlike sort of fantasy. And you know, that's why you never see, you know, you never see Batman really fraternizing with women, because he's like, well, he hasn't reached that stage in his life ever, you know, kind of thing. You know, that's
no, he always backtrack, much like Spider-Man. Like, they always backtrack on like, oh, he's got this relationship, and then either he dies or we move on to, or he doesn't.
And like, it's beautiful. There's a wholesome side to it, but there's also a side to it where it's like, oh, it's because he's still a child at heart, you know, and that's why he hasn't moved on from that part of his life. So he will forever be childlike, no matter how strong or how mature or how smart he has become. You know, he's still that kid, you know. And I think that's why it kind of works with, even to this day, where, you know, even when things become more, I don't want to use sanitized because that brings sort of negative sort of connotations, but you know what I mean? It still works for the current generation because...
Yeah, well, you have to justify things a lot more.
Yeah,
basically.
Exactly.
Just
where
Nightwing, for example, in recent comics, inherits a lot of money. His first reaction is to go like, well, I'm going to build social housing.
That's
a modern take on comic because the criticism that's been directed to Batman for ages has always been like, well, he's part of the problem because like he's a millionaire, but yet he only fights crime.
Like, well, again, that's going back to the whole, he's just a kid. That's why, you know, and people sort of accept that sort of wholesome, and that's why it works with kids. And in many ways, you know, that's why it works with adults, because, you know, it's dark, you know, it's also touches on other stuff, you know,
it's absurd, but like the grotesque of everything allows for a lot of different like direction. I've read recently Batman comics. I've even bought a Batman poster just like 2 days ago. Like there's that aesthetic element that makes the character still work. But that's the thing with James Bond, you can easily parody him, much like you could easily parody Batman.
Because you can also
translate it to the different cultures.
Yeah, exactly. Because James Bond, the thing about James Bond is like, you know, it represents a specific idea of masculinity and how one acts like a man, you know, whereas, you know, and that's that's something that changes constantly throughout the ages. Whereas what's the idea of what a boy should act like, that never really changes. It kind of remains quite constant. And I think that's what that's why Batman works. And whereas James Bond, it works sometimes, it works other times. You need to like sort of rewrite it, go back to the drawing board, because the idea of masculinity and what makes a man or a respectable gentleman even changes. You know,
The concept of like the respectful gentleman, like I think as you put it, there's all that class element, which is also something that's parodied in From Beijing Goes Love, because he is, after all, he's a butcher and he doesn't use a gun.
he has no money.
he's
given like a budget of like how many Hong Kong dollars or something like that.
Yeah, because they gave him like 200 yuan to dress himself, and I was like, that's probably very cheap. Like, I have no preference, but probably not enough.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, it's one of the reasons why I want to get a Stephen Chow from his earlier films, but you know, something that will, you know, that you will recognize even, because I don't want to do The Shining Soccer, because you know, I know you've seen that, and I don't want to do Comfort Hustle, because I think that's a different Stephen Chow, I think, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's probably his best, though, I would say. Shining Soccer, but Comfort Hustle
I think is incredible. I think it's his best as a director. I don't necessarily think it's representative of him as an actor or a comedic actor personally, but you know, as a director, I think it is his, like, it's up there, man. It's up there in terms of like what he wants to put in his film, in terms of reference and his reverence.
Coming back to the James Bond thing, there's also the fact that Stephen Chow, no matter how ridiculous he is still a good-looking man.
Oh, good,
and I think that's why also works with this character, is that when he transforms into that James Bond guy once they get him out of the butcher shop, you're like, okay, he's believable as a charismatic man. He's a leading man, except whatever he says, whatever comes out of his mouth makes no sense.
I think it's like it's that childlike element that kind of takes away the, like, you know, I wish he had like a, you know what I mean, it's like, he, you know what, I will say this, he is actually a good looking guy, but he's just it's that childlike element that sort of takes away the fact that it makes him a lot more, it kind of like skews his handsomeness just a bit to the side of what happened.
Talking about childlike, I mean, it's not nice to say that, but he's also kind of small. If he was slightly taller, it would be more harder to pass as a comedic actor.
As
he does, because yes, he's good looking, but he's slightly too small for
standards. He has a slight build.
Most leading men are slightly taller than him, and well, they always cast actors like women that are about the same height. In most James Bond, they always tall guys, and the woman is slightly smaller. There's that kind of like descending angle from like the men to the woman.
I would say
like they're equal. They're the same height.
And Pauline Chan, who I think she's actually really tall in real life, or was really tall. R.I.P. I think she passed away. But she's actually like, she dwarfs him.
You know, but she's made when she shows up. Like, you can easily see her as being like, oh, that's supermodel. A femme fatale. Supermodel. She was only taken to a comedic angle because of the flamethrower coming out of Everest. Otherwise, she doesn't have many lines. Yeah. And she still shows, so when she shows up, she's like, she's the real threat, basically. Whereas Anita Yu is a bit more like conflicted. The fact that she gets
I like the fact that Anita Yu is not your sort of conventional Bond girl. Yeah. She's like her own thing, I think, you know, to be honest with you.
So, because most of the time, like, Bond girls are never like that conflicted. They usually the money seems to be the motivation, but like, or maybe somebody been kidnapped, but like, I don't even recall any specific Bond woman that had as a motivation going like, oh, my father was kidnapped, so I have to kill you. Here it was more of a, well, it's a typically probably like Chinese context of like, your grandfather and father have betrayed the country, therefore you're responsible, which is something that for a Western audience would be like, what?
I don't understand why you're still attached to this, it is a very distinctively Chinese or cultural way of thinking of, like, that is kind of like, it's filial piety, but not I guess it is filial piety, because you're meant to be loyal to, because your nation is your parent, kind of thing in China's eyes. So yeah, that's kind of like an interesting sort of dynamic that Anita Yun sort of brings. I think the only time she comes across as a Bongo is actually not in the film, but in the posters. Because really? In the posters, she does actually dress kind of almost like a skimpy sort of like vegetable, James Bond or Bond girl outfit. But that was the only time that she comes across as a Bond girl. In the film, she doesn't come across as a Bond girl at whatsoever,
she has a lot more to do, because actually she's believable as a romantic partner.
Yeah. It works, because it's kind of like it works with the Stephen Chow's character, because you kind of think it's like, why would anyone like this guy?
Why would anyone like this guy? Because he's genuine. I think that's the thing that sells her on being like, I actually like him, because he genuinely cares.
Yeah.
He does. And that's always the thing with Stephen Chow in all of his, at least all the movies I've seen with him, is that when he says, I can destroy this wall, he's not talking shit. He actually can do it. It's not like, I don't know, a lot of comedic lead probably would say, like Leslie Nielsen probably would say, I can destroy this wall, and when we'll destroy the wall, but like by accident.
Yeah,
like they can do it, but like it's just like, it's a byproduct of them being clumsy. Or I could easily see also the movies where somebody says, I can do this, and then they have to build up to it, and the whole movie is them building up to achieving this goal. Whereas Stephen Chow, when he says that, oh, look at the fly, and he kills it, like, we only see it in the movie, in retrospect, that, oh, he actually killed the fly, but he's that good. He doesn't train for it. He's that good.
Yeah, but yeah, I think it also, it's like, Anita Yun, it's also nice to actually see her also be funny as well. She also takes part in the comedy. Like, I love that scene where, when Stephen Chow's kind of like, next time, I think it's best you just don't, sort of practice guns, she shoots the air. She's like, I want to practice wherever I like, and the ceiling fan like literally drops her. And it's like, she has like really good facial expressions in terms of like comedic, selling that sort of like, oh shit, what have I done kind of thing.
She is a bit like in those Zaz and Airplane movies, like you have, I can't remember who the actress who plays opposite the guy who drive, like who's flying the plane in Airplane, but like that woman is the same. She's very dramatic. She's over the top. But when it comes to asking, like, to delivering lines, she's pitch perfect.
Yeah.
And then Anita Yui at some point with, well, that infamous scene where they had to operate and divert the blood, he's like, oh, ask me a difficult question. And then she asks him a math problem.
I was like, oh, all right. And I love that scene, because it does balance between like sort of like the comedic element and also the tenderness about it. And that's really hard to make that scene tender when you're having a character watching porn, Do you know what I mean? It's just somehow they just made it, like they really solved the romance in that somehow, So yeah, no, all for like the two actors for like just selling the romance. I think at the end of the day, this film is first and foremost a very surprisingly romantic film, I think.
In quote unquote romantic film, like there's romance in it, but like let's not oversell it too much, because if you expect too much romance,
The Notebook, let's put it that way, but exactly. But actually, another, it's funny you mentioned the fly. Let's rewind about the fly part. Okay, so again, this is a reference, there's another reference that Stephen Chow he sort of highlights is his penchant for using a knife as opposed to guns. Okay, so when he mentions that, the knife, where he uses he actually mentions a name called, Fei Dou, And Sule
Fedor, Flying Daggers?
The Flying Daggers, yeah, or Little Lee Flying Daggers, as it's actually translated. And that's actually a reference to a wuxia novel series by Gu Long. Sule Fedor is essentially a wuxia novel series by Gu Long. And the premise is that it's a swordsman who leaves his wife and his home life to sort of make a name for himself as, you know, a famous sort of warrior in the Gong War, the Jang War. And his sort of signature sort of trait is his throwing knives, which Attack also uses. And yeah, the idea is that he never misses. You know, if you see a knife coming for you, it's going to get you, basically. And this particular hero is kind of, generally compared to like most swordplay heroes, he's more of an older gentleman, and he's kind of quite sickly. He has this cough as if like, oh, is he going to die, or is there something wrong with him? But it's never really overtly explained. But that's kind of like, he's meant to be a tragic figure in that he went out, he left his wife and he left his home life to actually make a name for himself, and he ends up sort of regretting it, and he's like, oh, I want the home life now, I want to be with the love of my life, I don't want the sword player, or I don't want to be famous. And I think the most popular example that Western audiences would know is the two Sentimental Swordsman films that stars Ti Lung or Dick Long, who's like a famous Shaw Brothers actor. And those two films are from Shaw Brothers as well. And there was a popular TV series called The Romantic Swordsman in 1978, starring Paul Chu, who you would know because Paul Chu was the handler for the Chang Yun Fat character in The Killer. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah. So again, he basically that character is meant to be sort of like a more older, more sort of like world weary gentleman of that particular novel series. And it's a reference that I guess Hong Kong audience will know, or fans of the genre will know, but it's a nice thing to highlight, because I think Stephen Chow, the character, he only sort of references it, and but you do see that reference come into play with the action scenes, where every time he throws a knife, there's like a swishing of the wind that makes the leaves sort of move, and then you see the result of like all the villains like sort of like bloodied up and just, you know, and stabbed. That's kind of like what you see in those novels, in those wuxia novels, is that that's right. How powerful Sule Fedor is. And I love the fact that Stephen Chow not only sort of like name drops the character, but also references that wuxia series through the action scenes, I think, you know.
Yeah, particularly, he's sometimes overtly sickly, if I remember correctly.
Yeah,
from Beijing Love.
He exactly.
Sometimes just like coughs like randomly, yeah. And I'm like, what's the point?
But like, I think whenever if you see that from here, it's most likely because he's just like, oh yeah, I'm trying to act like that guy, and then, you know, and I think that's part of him trying to be like, I want to be a hero, man. I want to be like, you know,
yes.
like the heroes that I read, you know. But yeah, and speaking of like action scenes, I have to say this film doesn't need to go this hard in terms of like action. I have to say some of the action, very well staged, particularly the one in that involved the bank robbery. Like the camera work is actually very well done, you know. I mean, it's not like, I mean, we don't see
the whole scene, yeah. Kind of comes out of nowhere, because it's just there to establish that he's heroic. But it takes ages movie.
Yeah, I was wondering how you would feel about that, because it's like when he spits on one of the gentleman's leg, and then they start conversing, and they're like, "Oh yeah, we're from the same village."
Yeah, exactly.
and you're like, "Where is this going? Where is this going?" All of a sudden, yeah, these two exactly. Like a big action scene. You know, it's like fucking hell, mate. God. Which I have to say, I wonder. It kind of makes me, this reminded me recently that, and you saw this film quite recently as well.
Oh, yeah.
This scene kind of reminds me of Long Arm of the Law.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
The idea of like mainlanders come to Hong Kong to make it big, but how they do it is actually rob juries, you know, jury stores, do you know what I mean?
True,
you know, kind of thing. And I wonder how, again, you know, Stephen Chow is very much on the pulse when it comes to like Hong Kong pop culture and also past cinema, you know, landmarks, you know. And, you know, Long Arm of the Law was a landmark, kind of, was a, you know, a landmark of its time, you know, when it was released in 1984, you know.
It's funny because when I watched it, I was really wondering about how much influence it had, because it's such a bleak film.
Mm.
it's really just so devastatingly bleak.
Yeah.
That I was looking at watching this, thinking like, "Well, that's very indie," and also like you can see there's not much budget in this, like
very indie,
very
yeah.
low budget,
yeah,
but it's great.
It's
really
amazing.
Works.
Yeah.
The second one is fantastic too.
Oh yeah, I love the second one. It's really hard to pick which one I prefer because it's a
good question. Yeah.
Because they're both really good in their own
ways. I don't think
ways.
You can. I think they're just both. They're so different. It's a really good follow up. We'll probably have to talk about it at some point because it's good shit.
But that's what the scene really reminded me of. And I wonder if that kind of like reminded you of that film, because you've seen those films quite recently.
I've seen those very recently. Yeah, I didn't think of Long Arm of the Law at the time, but like it's possible that it referenced that. Although we don't really spend that much time with the character, at least enough outside of that interaction where they compare and we're like, "Oh, we used to be in the same street. Oh, you killed my dog!" Like,
"You killed my dog? Did you really kill my dog?" They're like, "No." I just like, it's such a throwaway line, but I was listening to it. It's like, this is kind of like it sounded like it was going to escalate at one point. You know, I was like, "You killed my dog, didn't you?" You know, kind of thing. So,
yeah, and then it diverges to something else, but. But bottom line is really to establish that he's strong. The other thing that I loved about this particular film is that the particular scene is the fact that you can tell the movie has really been shot in 1994 and released in 1994.
Because
there's an ad for Speed and The Wolfman starring Jack Nicholson and Michelle Pfeiffer. Time has forgotten. Completely. I'd never seen it, but I saw the poster. I was like, I remember seeing that poster when I was a kid. I want to see this movie now. I want to see Wolf with Jack Nicholson and Michelle Pfeiffer. It must be some good schlock.
Yeah.
But like, the movie was definitely shot in 1994 because those two movies were released in 1994. So they really just like shot this shit and it was already like, enough that the movie poster was still current. Like, that's effectiveness.
Yeah. And it's like, and it shows that how. Especially at that time. I mean, it's funny because Hong Kong cinema at that time, I mean, this was 1994. So this was just a few years before the handover. And this was kind of like a few years before Hong Kong was starting to, I guess, feel the burn of like diminishing returns later on. And it's funny because they actually mentioned Jurassic Park.
They do, explicit. Is it dinosaurs like Jurassic Park rah-rah or Jurassic Park rah-rah?
Yeah. And it's like, and it's funny because it's kind of like, don't worry, Chinese dinosaurs don't kill kids. I was like, oh, that's just hilarious. Because, Stephen Chow's character will be the one to believe. Oh, good, that's good. That's good to know. But it's funny because Jurassic Park is actually quite a significant film in Hong Kong cinema or Hong Kong culture, because that did gangbusters. I mean, it did gangbusters around the world, but it did particularly in the Hong Kong. And that film actually scared a lot of industry people, specifically people who worked in action films in Hong Kong, because prior to that, Hong Kong action films could quite easily compete with Hollywood cinema in terms of action, because, you know, they had their own style, and it's like, it's like the only thing that Hollywood had going for is like pyrotechnics and like the whole idea of like gunplay, which obviously, you know, with Hong Kong, well, we can match you. We could look at our John Woo films. When Jurassic Park came about, apparently this was actually a thing. You know, I read this, or someone was talking about it at least, is that when Hong Kong action directors were starting to watch Jurassic Park, they finally was like, oh shit, I don't know how we're going to like sort of compete with that, you know, or how do we compete with that type of spectacle? Because that clearly has a lot of money behind it. And we were able to get by being like sort of ingenious with, you know, with our action in terms of like we're putting like real people and real stunts. And when that became not enough, it all became like, oh, what can we do with the computers and how can we put that on screen? Then it's like, oh shit, you know, I don't know how you're gonna compete with that. And you post 90, the mid-90s, I think somewhere around 97, you do see Hong Kong cinema start becoming more like Hollywood in more ways than one. They're trying to like incorporate special effects with admittedly mixed results, because at the end of the day, they don't have the the budget or the resources as like the same way that Hollywood does, you know, kind of thing. So
yeah, especially like I rewatched True Lies just yesterday.
Yeah,
and True Lies is also from 94.
Mm. Oh, and yeah, True
Lies,
yeah, yeah,
yeah, and True Lies got some action scenes, well, specifically at the end with the airplane. I was this looks still okay.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Even on some big TV where you see every detail and you easily see actually who the where the stunt double for Charles Nigger. Yeah,
where you can see the seams in the
With the horse,
the
horse riding scene, like there's tons of shots where you're like, "That's not Schwarzenegger, that's definitely somebody else."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Especially on HGTV now, like it's so noticeable.
Oh god,
But bottom line, when it comes to the scenes with the airplane at the end, I was like, "Yeah, this like I still believe in this plane. I don't know how they shot that, but it looks alright."
Yeah.
So that was really high level special effect, and I can easily see what you mean. Like everything. Boost like on top of Jurassic Park, which Jurassic Park visually is still just pitch perfect. Like I don't really like, I don't look back fondly at all the Jurassic Park movie. I enjoy the ideas of them, but I didn't enjoy them that much.
Okay,
nowadays.
Let's put it this way: I don't give a shit about dinosaurs, but I understand why it's such a big thing.
I love dinosaur stills, but like for me, it's the kids.
Oh, okay.
As an adult. As an adult, I could care less about those children.
Right.
Sam Neill is fantastic. Like Laura Dern is like Jeff Goldblum, Laura Dern, like just you know, like bless, but like all those children, like all those movies where the children are in danger. I'm like, you know, there's at no point do I believe children are in danger nowadays in a Hollywood film.
Yeah.
So that's the part where I'm like, okay, let's move on.
Let's move along
because
from the
it's
kids,
not
yeah.
it's not that it doesn't scare me.
Yeah.
But the rest is just certainly perfect. Like, there's no, like, and it's, and also, I mean, that's just my sensibility. Like, I'm pretty sure, like, other people would feel different. So I'm not, I just cannot.
At the time,
I loved dinosaur. Every person from my generation was so into dinosaurs.
Okay,
it was, the tattoo artist, I'm getting, like, I got a big tattoo coming up, like, probably this year, maybe a bit later too.
To finish,
it's gonna take a while.
Years, yeah,
but the person who does my tattoo, he sells Jurassic Park posters, and he's done a lot of like dinosaur tattoos, and he does them very well. But like, I'm not surprised at all that he can easily find people who be like, "Oh yes, I want a tattoo of a dinosaur." Like, yes, put that on me. Like, it's a thing that people will be very very keen on because. Because dinosaurs, man, they're sick.
I take your word for it because
if you
I'm
don't
not
get
really.
It, that's fine.
I'm not into dinosaurs. Sorry, I'm sorry, guys. Dinosaurs. I'm just not into dinosaurs. I enjoyed Jurassic Park back in the day, but I wouldn't. I'm in no hurry on watching it again. And but
if we're another kind of podcast, this episode will be titled "I'm Not Into Dinosaurs."
And it's like, it would be a comedy podcast. There's no way people would take me seriously, quite frankly. I was like, what's a stegosaurus? I was like, I don't know. But no, so that film was a big deal in Hong Kong. I think it was one of those films that kind of did shook the industry people somewhat in the core, because it's kind of like, well, where do we go to compete with this, you know, kind of thing. And it's nice that I think... I don't know if it's Stephen Chow acknowledging that, or if he's just him just riffing on the fact that Jurassic Park came out, it was popular. I'm just going to take the piss off it, you know, kind of thing. So
I think it's probably noticeable because, and probably part of the general conversation, because that's the only movie they explicitly like by title reference in the dialogues. That's the only time they can easily do reference to Robocop or Terminator, for example. They never do. Like, maybe visually you could find it, but
they say it. They're so dismissive of it, which makes it so just ridiculous, you know. And I wonder if that's coming from a place or a mindset. It's similar how, you know, this film, you know, depicts China. It's like, there's no way this film will ever come out today because of like, because it's
because of the end of how he escapes being shot.
Yeah, Exactly.
That was great.
I'm going to bribe this guy so I don't get the shot. It's like China will not have any of
yeah,
it.
No, it's very, very not going to happen.
Yeah. But it's so it's, and I don't know if that's him being like mindful of that or he's just like, yeah, I'm just responding to you know, people's.
I think
know,
it's more responding. I don't see Stephen Chow as being mindful. I think his humor is very much somebody who likes not try to like be controversial, but I don't think he tries to not be controversial or yeah. like tries to not offend.
Yeah.
It's just that his sensibility on the other hand, I think yeah. translates pretty well.
Yeah.
Still nowadays.
There's... And to be fair, you know, I can say this because I come from a a Hong Kong family. I know Chinese culture well enough to know that Chinese people, Hong Kong people, are not the most sensitive people around in terms of like, oh, we shouldn't say shit like that. You know, do you know what I mean? Or we shouldn't mention that. I know they are and they are not. They are in terms of like tradition and filial piety. I mean, I think this is boils down to the fact of values and what they value. Where else, but you know, it, as opposed to let's say race or you know,
yeah,
or
okay,
same
yeah.
sex, you know, married, they would literally not hold back in terms of like how they feel about it. You know, and it's kind of
yeah.
like
Yeah, this movie doesn't have jokes that I could really point out as being racist or homophobic or transphobic. Mm. There's one part when he watches the porn movie where I brace myself because he says like, oh, like he encouraged someone and like Anita is like, what are you talking about? And he does say like, oh, no, I'm talking to the black guy on screen, like go harder. And I'm like, I was at this point, yeah. Okay, what's the next line going
yeah,
to be?
Yeah, yeah.
And then,
but there's no next line, really.
Like... Yeah, he just moves on. That's
yeah,
the only joke
yeah,
is that
yeah,
he points
exactly.
out to the to who's on screen
yeah,
and refers
yeah, yeah.
to
yeah.
like, he say, well, there's a black man on screen, and that's
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, if that's the only moment where we have a racist joke, like that's, I don't think that even counts.
Yeah, yeah.
I might
because
be wrong,
you know
but
what?
Like,
I will say that's. That's very good, especially for that time. Especially,
yes.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Because,
yeah,
you know, I've seen enough films where they just go hard when it comes to, like, highlighting some race.
Are you referencing the Scary Movie series?
A series and they're not even Hong Kong
where,
films, man.
They're not even Hong Kong films.
Oh,
in that
god.
Era, oh my god, like racism was like just basically, I mean, it's still very much everywhere. Like nowadays, you wouldn't be able to get away with big production to jokes
yeah.
like this where you're like, yeah, like that didn't even age well the minute they were set.
You won't get films like White Chicks at all today. Remember
no,
that film? God.
No. Yeah, but like, here it's fine.
It's just him highlighting who was the guy, and it's more it's kind of like that's just
and in terms of sexism, I would say he's more the butt of the joke than anybody else.
Oh god, yeah, absolutely.
And
the only
time where there's something a bit violent happening in to a woman, that's during the beginning credit in the intro, and I don't want to spoil it, but I laugh very hard at this. But because also it's ludicrous, like there's no way you're taking this very seriously.
Yeah.
So yeah, overall for a comedy from the 90s, it has aged pretty well. I wouldn't say it has aged like fine wine, but it's fine. It's still.
Oh no!
I would.
I don't care what you say. I think it
I laughed very, very hard. Like, I think also I was born in that era, so I'm fine with all those jokes and like the tempo.
Yeah.
Because I think that's also the thing. Like, if you're younger than 40 or 30, maybe this movie will not work for you. Not because the jokes are not like of the time, but like, at least they are of the time in terms of the tempo, in terms of how they're done. Comedy evolves. Not just in what you can say, but rather how you say it. And I think for me, this movie is very much a Zaz. Like, it has the kind of tempo that Zaz movie has. And I'm not sure a younger audience watches Airplane now and life is half as hard as 30 to 40 year old. Even 30 to 40 year old who have never seen Airplane and not watching it as a nostalgic thing of like, I remember liking this. But more of a, oh, this works for me because it's that kind of cultural era. Again, comedy is connected to culture.
Probably to culture and also time as well. Yeah, it's not just it's culture. A lot
more,
yeah,
a lot more than anything else, maybe. And for me, From Beijing with Love still works. As a 40-year-old man, I'm watching this. I get all the cultural references, which is most of them.
Yeah, I'm saying you did get most of them, yeah.
Yeah, like this part of it that you explained, I was like, I have no clue that this was one. And that's probably part of the movie where I felt like, that's not funny, because I didn't get it. But even if you are somebody from, like, who is much younger, I say 20 in their 20s, watching this, I'd be very curious. And I have no idea.
I'd be very curious. Yeah,
highly curious to know if this works.
Even the fact that you, even if you approach it with the mindset, oh, this is riffing off James Bond, like, I would say most, like, people in their teens or early 20s would just know the Daniel Craig era of the.
Yeah,
that's not what it's riffing on, really.
No, it's not.
If you think about it, yeah.
Yeah, it's riffing on others. It's riffing on a specific idea of what men are like.
Yeah.
Because he aspires to be a parody of a man. Like, that's who he aspires to be. Whereas, actually, Anita is attracted to him for all the things that he's failing to do.
Yeah.
Because deep down, yeah, he's.
Well, no, I think, you know, there was that moment there was a comedic moment where Anita Yun's character, like, shoots Atat, and then Atat, you know, goes in hiding, but he comes out of hiding for some ridiculous reason. And even that, I was a bit like, what are you doing? You're going to get shot, you know, kind of thing. And when he does get shot, it's meant to, like, yeah, it's kind of dramatic, but it's also kind of funny. It was like, oh, you did it, you know, at your own sort of peril there. But then you get the reveal of, like, oh, here's a rose. And it's kind of like, oh, so that, you know, you showed that in that buffoonery, you reveal your sort of tenderness as a person. And that's when you're like, oh, you know, because as an audience, I'm like, oh, okay, you know what? I respect you for that, you know, so even if it's, like, kind of fucking stupid. And I could see someone kind of falling for someone for doing something as ridiculous, but yet it's coming from a heartfelt place.
He's a moron, but he cares. Yeah. Like, I'm sure a lot of women can describe their husband like this. Like, where's your husband? He's a moron, but he cares. Like, okay.
You know what?
I understand.
Because you watched this with your partner. I'm fascinated at what they thought of the film, actually.
I think they didn't laugh as much as I did, but they were still into it for most of it.
Okay.
And I think we probably laughed both at the same thing. Without any problem, or there were no moments where I was laughing and I would turn around and Eddie would be like that never happens.
Oh, like, okay, then they never were like, oh, I don't know about that, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we watched True Lies yesterday, and they had never seen True Lies. And they had, like, I watched it enjoying a lot more of the action schlock and kind of, like, ignoring the fact that it's a movie about a man who basically constantly lies to his wife. And at the end, she's like, it's all right. We'll just go and kill people together. Like,
yeah.
Okay, that's okay. other people, but I enjoy it. I still love True Lies. I think it's a great movie.
Yeah, I really want to watch it again, because I do remember being like, oh, wow, Schwarzenegger can actually do comedy.
Schwarzenegger can do comedy, her name escapes me. This is really annoying, but... yes, and Jamie Lee Curtis, incredible.
Yeah.
In so many aspects, like, there's the word is applied to overall performance, be it the most dramatic element, the most moments where she's a most, like, cheapish, as being like, oh, and you believe this motherfucker, like, was trying to sell you on the idea of a spy, and you're like, oh, I still care about her. And then when she's hot as hell,
I know, right?
I was like, oh wow, you, in terms of acting, like she was able to switch up like really quickly. Like not many actresses can really do it and do it well. Yeah, I'm like, oh,
this
wow.
scene, that the striptease scene is probably the most memorable thing out of the movie. Like if you take out the special effects at the end, like all the action is really well done.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's the part where I'm like, you know what? If I think of Hot Shots 2, Hot Shots 2 parodies a lot of that extreme action very well because it's easy to parody something. Yeah, like, you can do a good parody of this. But her sexiness, on the other hand, it's like, it's just untouchable. Like, she's incredibly awesome doing it. Such confidence.
Yeah.
Just like the body language, the choreography, like, just perfect. Yeah. And she's hot as hell. Like, to sum it up, Jamie Lee Curtis is hot as hell in this role. And that's the thing that you can't take away from a performance at all outside of everything else in this movie. So, yeah, True Lies, that's a movie that I think hasn't aged necessarily well, or at least where we had probably a difference in terms of how we reacted to most of the jokes, whereas, like, From Beijing with Love, that was fine. Like, worked
that's
pretty
good
well.
To know. That's good to know, because, you know, it's like, I think with, like, I'm always very hesitant to sort of introduce Stephen Chow's sort of back catalogue, because it's like, what would be, like, a good one to sort of, like, for them to sort of like grasp hold of, do you know what I mean?
It's my partner, like, we have also watched Kung Fu Hustle on several occasions, so
it's
different, you said.
It's different, because Kung Fu Hustle and like Shaolin, and even Shaolin Soccer, they're more palatable with international audience. You know, and it's kind of like, and I think this is
a good in between.
Yeah, there's a nice, it's a good in between, I think, and it, you know, and it's very but, you know, there's a reason why, despite the success of Shaolin Soccer and Kung Fu Hustle, only, I would say, a handful dare to go into, just research Stephen Chow and just go into his back catalogue.
But there's a lot more now being released.
You know what? Surprisingly so. You know, there's like, we had Forbidden City Cult, which is kind of like a pseudo spiritual sequel to From Beijing with Love, actually. I use that term, because it's kind of weird. It's like, it still incorporates the James Bond parody, but it's actually set in period China, like in the Wuxia days, which is like strange. But I think those two films are definitely linked. And then, you know, they released
Fight Back to School. That's Back to School,
which, to be fair, I'm surprised that for me, that was the film that probably would play well most with international audiences, because it's essentially 21 Jump Street, you know, in my mind. You know, that's essentially the same premise. And then they've just released Royal Tramp, the two film collection, which I really want to, like, I want to revisit, because those I remember really enjoying them, but I do remember them being like, they're probably the least inaccessible. I don't know, I may be wrong about that, you know, but I'd be interested to see how they hold up with the I enjoy them, because I just like a genre that takes piss out. And
we need to watch, I still need to watch All for the Winner.
Yes.
Gotta Gamblers,
you know,
parody.
Exactly. And I think you would definitely appreciate it, because, you know, Gotta Gamblers well enough to be like, yep, I probably will get most of the humor.
I would imagine my partner would also get it. I really hope there's going to be a box set that's going to be reissued with everything, because there is a French one.
Yeah,
but I need English subtitles.
It doesn't. And it doesn't have All for the Winner. I've checked the box set on that. And
it doesn't have
All for the Winner. Which, you know, the longest time that was a hard film to get on Blu-ray, and my friend, hi Gary, bought it for me.
Gary getting all the props, like
he's
Gary,
getting all the
Gary,
props,
Gary.
Man. Woo! Name dropping Gary Bettison.
Gary.
He bought me the All for the Winner Blu-ray, and that's like the only Blu-ray existence which is uncut, you know, guy.
Right.
I'm like, wow. So that's like the holy grail of like Hong Kong cinema right there. But that film, I think a lot of the reason why that film was never really part of any sort of God of Gamblers block set because it was made by a different studio. In fact, it was actually meant to be a parody of God of Gamblers, but it just retroactively became part of the universe because it was just so popular. I guess money speaks, you know, or money talks, you know, as they say. So yeah. But, you know, from Beijing with Love, a great film, in my opinion, you know. Still holds up, I think. I think it still holds up, you know. Well staged action, I have to say, very well staged action. So you can enjoy it on that level, but you can enjoy it from a comedic on a comedic level as well, or even like a piece of history. I don't know. Is there anything else you want to?
I don't think so. I think that's all. It's just also it sums up for me all the way because I think it still holds up and it's still a very very funny movie.
Yeah, yeah, and it's like and the final action scene. Again, it's like you great. Know, it's great. You know, it's it brings together like the whole Tatsunoko sort of element, and you know the Chambara films with its pause before the blood splatter that comes out of it. It's really great stuff. And clearly Stephen Chow loves cinema, whether it be Hong Kong or Japanese or even like American, and he just want to express it in some way, shape, or form. It is actually readily available now on Blu-ray by Eureka, which is great. Uncut, you know, has a really great subtitles. I think it's like at this moment the best version out there in terms of because the Blu-ray was released. Another Blu-ray was released prior to this, but it was good. But there was an issue with an audio actually that I've actually noticed because. So there was the shot where Stephen Chow's character gets shot in the leg?
Yes.
Okay, so you only hear like one gunshot because that's all you see, just one shot on the leg.
Yeah.
For some reason, on the Hong Kong Blu-ray, or was it, and the Hong Kong DVD, I believe, as well, you get the shot, but you hear like three more shots, three more gunshots followed by, and it's like you don't see anything. That's clearly a glitch. Someone like screwed up the sound there. He screwed the pooch on the sound there because it didn't exist on. Yeah, it didn't exist on the VCD, and it definitely did. Yeah, and it's definitely like it comes out of nowhere, but it's definitely not in the Blu-ray, which is good because clearly, the quality control department.
And
I recommend it for anyone who's interested in Stephen Chow or even just Hong Kong comedies in general.
And if you like Zaz
Airplane.
Or James Bond parodies,
I mean, a lot of people, you know, when they think of James Bond parodies, they think of the Austin Powell films.
I think the Austin Powell probably have ageless, not as well as this.
Yeah, I was never really a big fan of those in the beginning when I was, I think I must have been in, or at least close to sixth form actually. Even then, I was like, I don't know, it's not really working for me personally. And it's just, and I think it's more of a comedy style that I just, you know, I do like Mike Myers, I like Wayne's World.
Yeah, Wayne's World was great.
Yeah, yeah, but I
both Wayne's World work.
Yeah, but for some reason, I never really quite gravitated towards the Austin Powers. Sorry, guys, for anyone who are fans of Austin Powers, I'm sorry, but it's like, yeah, it's not really my thing.
It is
what it is. So, yeah. From Beijing with Love, you know, off to a bang, 2024. First episode of the year.
Yes.
And if it's done bi-monthly, then, you know, hopefully we'll be like 12 episodes in, you know, and, you know, we already were planning our 12th Christmas special.
Oh, yes.
We've also spoken about what we're going to do next as well, which yes, I'm we also have. Very excited. You know what? I'm so excited that I probably won't be bothering watching a film because I just know it by heart.
Oh wow!
I probably will have to like skim. I have to skim through it just to like remind myself. But I know it well enough because it's like
classic.
It is one, yeah, it's a classic. It's one of my favorite films, and I love it. So look forward to that. Hope you all had a great Christmas and New Year, and you know, here's to having a very fruitful 2024. Anything you want to say, Matt?
Nope, just stay safe. Have a great one. Thank you for listening, and see you next month.
See you next month.
Bye.